Hi everybody, hope you're well. My name is Jim Carroll. Welcome you to the weekly podcast from the Banter team as we resume business after a few weeks off. This week we say hello to Kevin Barry, the author of one of our favourite novels of recent years, City of Bahan. We caught up with Limerick man at the Shannon Rowing Club in the heart of his native city over the summer during the Make a Move Festival for a conversation which covered all the bases from freelance journalism, promoting raves and guts, to Jim Kimmy, the art of writing, and his new book, Beetlebone, about John Lennon and an island in County Mayo. Welcome along to Banter here at Make a Move. Please give a warm welcome to the first man to ever order and drink a cappuccino in Limerick, Kevin Barry.
<laughs> 1984, in a cafe called Huckleberry's, that used to be down underneath Spades, and they introduced cappuccinos, and I remember we were looking up at the board and going, will we try one? Yeah, come on. So all I ask is a small plaque that could be put up on the wall nearby, down there.
You also do some really interesting carbon dating. When we were talking inside, you remember the very first time you encountered breakdancers outside Todd's on Hall Street.
Yeah, I was thinking after been down at the Russengano family last night about the first manifestation of hip-hop culture I remember in Limerick, and I could date it exactly, I'd say, to summer 85, when young fellas started showing up with rolls of lino outside Todd's on Saturday afternoon. I remember too, there was a guy, I can't remember his name, from Hyde Road, who was a really good breakdancer. And then there was a kind of a fat lad from Ballinanty who was desperate. I always be saying, like, he's going to hurt himself if he doesn't stop. But and then I'd say the same summer, the old Savoy Bar, which was the Pink Elephant then, they had a room at the back where they used to have discos, and they started letting the breakdancing young fellas in. And they'd no DJ or anything, they just have their ghetto blasters and we'd just all go in and look at them. I wasn't a breakdancer, I was a teenage goth at this stage. And it's an awful sad thing to be a ginger goth. All the pain that went into my system over the years really dates back to being the tragedy of being a ginger-haired goth, because you can't get it right, you know?
Were you a mod before that?
Was I, which?
Were you a mod before
I had that? A kind of a mod phase when I was a kind of, 12 or 13. I was into kind of the specials and stuff like that. Loads of phases, though. The goth one lasted a while. But you'd have the hair perfect, and you'd be back home in it for 3 hours in the morning, and Kansas Studio Line hairspray, and it'd be just the same as Ian McCulloch out of Echo and the Bunnymen, but you still didn't look like Ian McCulloch out of Echo and the Bunnymen. I think, fuck it anyway, you know. I'm gonna
So, like, you know, you said there you were watching the lads down the Savoy, you know, and with a ghetto blaster. You sort of had an entrepreneurial bent to you as well. You were a club promoter as well.
I was, yeah. I was talking to my friend Ethan Akana, who'd know well, the DJ and promoter, during the week about it. And we used to put on dance nights in, and we claimed to be the first purest dance nights in Limerick, I think about 1991. Again in the Savoy, in the top floor, on Wednesday nights, there was a thing called YAH. And our DJ was called DJ Wiz. So you could tell where it was going straight away. And I was putting on those for a while, and then Aoife went to Dublin, and I was putting on stuff with a fella called Rob. And it started to get more popular. I remember we put on one on Christmas week, and it had an awful cheesy name. It was called Santa Delica. And she's about 300 people or something paid in, and I immediately became that corrupt promoter figure. I just started, forgot all about the music straight away, and started, geez, if we could get a hold and take 450 now. But I remember looking around that night in there, it was about 250, 300 people, and they were all off their faces, and it was great, and we had a load of DJs from around the country, and about 5 visits from the Henry Street Drug Squad over the course of the night. And I was thinking, oh, Jesus, this is taking off lovely now, you know? But then it was kind of very unpredictable for a while. Put on another one for Valentine's night, and we lost our shirts. And I remember actually physically running out of the Savoy, so not to pay the rental of the room, and having to run out of a printer's shop and not pay for the posters. It was an awful mess, really. So, was this
at the same time as you were kind of being a jobbing journalist as well?
I was, yeah. I used to work in the Limerick Post at that stage, and I used to run off the flyers on the sly at lunchtime, off the photocopiers and the posters. But it was, Yeah, we kind of, a lot of us had started going up and down to Cork a lot, yeah. Going to Sir Henry's, which was kind of a very inspirational kind of nightclub for a lot of people, and running buses up and down. And it was funny at that time. I mean, you know, I left Limerick in 93, and it was very different than it is now. I mean, it culturally, it didn't have the kind of self-confidence that it has now. And it was the sense that if you wanted to go to something good, you had to go to Cork or go to Galway, you know. Those places had more established kind of scenes in lots of ways.
Yeah.
And it was just a kind of a historical thing, I think, because, you know, Cork had always had the jazz festival and film festivals and things like that. It was just a bit bigger. And Galway had always had kind of tourism and that kind of cultural stuff passing through, whereas Limerick struggled. There wasn't much going on. It was a very depressed time economically still. So it was kind of...
That was down to the fact maybe lots of people who would be doing stuff like that had decided to depart?
Yeah, and that I think that's the big change now, is that people kind of hang around and stick around, because you don't have to, you know, before, if you were in a band or if you were trying to write a book or if you were trying to paint pictures or whatever you were doing culturally, you know, that the plan was essentially you'd go to London or New York or Dublin at least, and you'd do it there, which doesn't happen anymore, you know, because increasingly now I think the most important thing for all sorts of artists is to keep their overheads low, because it's so unpredictable how to make money out of it now. So it makes an awful lot of sense to live in a place where the rents are cheaper and where you can operate at a far, far lower cost, you know. But yeah, and I mean, I think as well there's a geographical thing with Ireland. Like, you always have to remember, it's such a small island. And when you have three cities like an hour away from each other, like Cork, Limerick and Galway, they are kind of competing for kind of cultural resources, you know. And Limerick struggled for a long time, I think. And it didn't. And it was also the fact that, you know, there wasn't a huge kind of, at that time anyway, literary scene, for example, in my end of things in town. Like Michael Curtin was publishing novels in England, but that was it. And he was almost this mythical figure who you'd see around town. And when there aren't other people doing what you want to do, it seems like a kind of an unlikely endeavour to be setting yourself up for. You know, you think, oh, Jesus, how will this work out? Whereas, you know, Galway and Cork had advantages then that they kind of, you know, I think it's levelled out an awful lot over the last while. I mean, yeah, I was a journalist then, and I used to be very... I used to be at council meetings right over there in the old council building on Monday afternoons, bored out of my tits now, like I used to hate it. But it was actually, in retrospect, a really interesting time, because there was a really good city manager who was actually from Cork, ironically, called Jack Higgins, and he was very involved with getting Limerick to kind of turn 180 degrees on its axis and face onto the river. He said, what's the story here? Like, the city kind of built itself away from the river, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, crazy Irish mythological stuff about rivers causing tuberculosis and all this kind of mad stuff, but the city had built itself away from the river. And he was one of the people, and there was an architect called Jim Barrett there at the time, the city architect, who sort of realised this is the great thing in the town, you know, and if it builds onto that. And over, when I'd be coming back visiting in the mid and late 90s, you could almost see it month by month and week by week turning on its axis to face onto the river. And I think, you know, when you transform the space like that, everything else will start to go with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, aside from kind of, I suppose, finding out about like geographical repointing and repositioning as well, I mean, I say those council meetings were a great place to pick up dialogue as well.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, one of my favourites was the late Jim Kemmy, who was like a really brilliant guy, and he was really right on, you know, but really, really funny as well. And you'd have great chats with him and stuff. I'd meet him around town. I remember talking to him, really interesting actually, but it must have been 80s still, it must have been about 1989, and Limerick had just started getting the kind of Stab City kind of headlines, you know? And and everyone was giving out about it at the council meetings, and I remember Jim saying to me one day, what's their problem? So we're knifing each other left, right and centre. But... And I was saying, I remember asking him, I said, why is it always knives? And he said, they're very unimaginative. But, and that was, it was around the time these feuds were kind of starting as well around the place. And I remember having this very soulful conversation with him over by Poor Man's Kilkee, just across the road one day. We were kind of wintry day looking out across the water. And I was going, Jim, what to be wrong with us at all, you know, with all this trouble? And he said, I don't know, I said, but I think it's coming in off the river. And I stole that as the first line of City of Bohan. But yeah, the very best kind of dialogue hunting really was in the district court. That was phenomenal, like, for dialogue on Thursdays. There was one guy, and I'm not going to name any names about the district court meetings, but there was one guy who was who would never accept a state solicitor. I'm defending myself, Your Honour, every week. And he was always up for every week, and he used to come out with these brilliant sort of poetical defences, crazy stuff, you know. I always remember him being sent down for 6 months for something one time and being led out in handcuffs from the court and stopping in the middle of the floor and turning around and facing up to the judge and going, I'm ashamed to live in a land where justice is only a game. I just thought, like... And you could never make it up, you know, as long as you were there. But my very favourite... I used to look forward to it every year. My favourite sitting at the district court was the one that took place on the Thursday after the 2FM beat on the street. The evidence table would be heaving with the weapons that were confiscated at the beat on the street when the 2FM roadcaster came down. I always remember one young fella had a sword taken off him. And you just kind of have to love the mentality of a young fella going down to the open air disco. What'll I bring? Sword, you know. But it was, they eventually stopped coming for the meeting the street. But that used to be hilarious, that the evidence table would be literally under nunchy coos and everything. But it was, it reminded me actually later, about 15 years later, I was living in Liverpool for a while, and it very similar cities. Limerick and Liverpool have so much in common. They could be a bit hairy late at night around the place, but kind of great atmosphere and kind of mad energy and kind of madcap kind of humour and stuff there as well, you know. And both also cities struggled with other nearby cities that were very successful culturally, like Liverpool, when I was there, really struggled with Manchester in the way that Limerick kind of struggles still a bit, I think, with the fact of Galway and Cork being on either side and having kind of bigger and longer established festivals and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's lots of similarities I always found between the two. Port cities as well have this kind of weird kind of vibration.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, it comes in off the river, you know?
Oh, totally.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, like, so when you go back to say the Tribune and the Post, and you're writing up these reports in Kevin, you know, you're writing up about the swords at the kind of like the Post beat on the street, Pacal. You have all these kinds of pieces. At what stage did you realize, you know, as you're writing them up, and you're kind of, I can imagine as well, like, you know, you're in a newspaper, and a lot of these stories are they're great paragraphs and they're great stories and they're great headlines, and you'll occasionally get read out on one of the radio shows or whatever.
Yeah.
At what stage did you realize it's like, I mean, actually, you know, I can do more than this, and I want to do more than this. Or was there always a kind of feeling of you wanted to be a writer as opposed to being a journalist?
Yeah, I had a kind of long and melodramatic teenage poet phase in my goth days that involved me lying around the graveyard over in the cathedral, reading Keats kind of poems with Nick Cave on the Walkman, you know. And not writing awful stuff. But no, in my early 20s, I was kind of attempting bits of fiction, but in a very undisciplined way. Mostly after I'd moved to Cork, I was trying to write stories and stuff, but it was typically about 5 a.m. after crawling home from Henry's on all fours, you know, that you'd be trying. And it would never kind of live up to it. It seemed like magic when it was coming out of the pen, but when you look back at it the next day, it was, oh, Jesus, you know. I slowly got more disciplined, I think, over the course of my 20s about making it the primary thing that I was trying to do. It takes an awful long time. You have to write an awful lot of drivel in terms of fiction before you start getting, unless there are horrible, lucky exceptions who write amazing stuff in their 20s. For most writers, you have to write out all your influences, you know? And I was definitely trying to be my favourite writers at the time. I was convinced I was the next great American Jewish novelist, really. You know, I was trying to be Saul Bellow or Philip Roth or something like this. I think around the end of the 90s or 2000, 2001, I started to write some kind of stories and bits that seemed to me to be kind of working more. But it took me a while to start even sending stuff out as well, you know, because I didn't feel it was quite ready. I attempted lots, made lots of kind of false starts at novels and things that didn't work out. But when I sat down writing the City of Bohan novel, which would be my first novel, I knew straight away it would be published and everything. It just felt right. And actually the biggest challenge always, I think, in any writer's kind of day or life is figuring out what should be on your desk at a particular time, you know. Sometimes you're trying to write stories that you're years away from being able for. Yeah. But kind of when I sat down to write a portrait of a small, deranged, crazy kind of West of Ireland city, I had all the district court meetings under my belt and all the council meetings. And, you know, I'd lived in Limerick for 20-odd years and Cork for almost 10 years, so you had the kind of voices and the kind of language there. Yeah. Crazy, deranged way we use the English language and abuse it and turn it inside out. It was just kind of timing, really.
Yeah.
But the great thing about writing fiction is they still call you a young writer when you're about 40, you know, which is a fabulous thing.
You talked there about like what you got in Limerick in terms of district courts and your move from being a mod to being a god to being a cure head to being a hip hop entrepreneur and running out on all your bills. When you were in Cork, what did you get out of Cork? I mean, like I'm curious about what you were doing down there. You know, aside from kind of going to Henry's and that. I mean, who you're writing for? You know, and like what you were involved in kind of hip hop projects as well. Just to bring it back to kind of what the team.
And oh yeah, I made the great lost Cork hip-hop documentary. Myself and a friend of mine called DJ Fork, we in 1996 or 7, I think, there was a hip-hop festival for a weekend. I remember a Tribe Called Quest came to it, actually.
Yeah, Southern Soul and Disco Festival.
So that was it, exactly. And we did lots of, and Arlaw and the local kind of hip-hop crews were getting going at that stage as well. And we filmed loads of it. And then we ran out of money and we had no money to edit it. So I think they wiped the tapes after a while and it was lost. And it was an awful shame because we had great stuff, I think, with some of the people who were visiting from the US and with some of the local crowd as well. It got kind of more organized. I think Shane, I suppose, would have been doing stuff around here from around that time as well, and stuff in Galway with the lads up there. So it was, what I loved actually, what seemed to me, like when I went to Cork, it definitely had that sense of having more self-confidence culturally at that time, in that people were trying to put stuff on all the time and real DIY.
Yeah.
Or what people of an older generation would call a punk ethic, you know, of doing it yourself and putting on nights and stuff. And also, I mean, it wasn't down on itself. And this is the other great change in Limerick since then as well. Limerick still in the early 90s, up to when I lived there, it was kind of very down on itself all the time. And you talk to people and all people say they hate the fucking place, you know, I can't wait to get out of it. Like, and I moved down to Cork and they all loved it. Cork is superb, really, you know. Everything you need is within a quick stroll to the Grand Parade. We have superb nightclubs and restaurants in there. I was going, they actually like where they live, you know. This is a dramatic thing for me. But it's, I think that the two cities are very kind of sisterly or brotherly as well and have influenced each other a lot, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of interchange between the two, and all of that came out of sort of the club scenes, I think, in the 90s as well.
Yeah.
Also it was the fact that I no longer had a day job when I was down there. I was freelancing, writing for Hot Press and stuff, and bits for the Irish Times and things like that, and The Examiner. And so I had more time to sort of be writing terrible short stories, you know, and getting all the sort of dribbly stuff out before I could get at anything halfway decent. So, yeah, it was very important.
Yeah. Did you find as well, I mean, obviously when you went from a situation where you work for the Post and Tribune, where you kind of have to cover courts, you had your beat to cover, you know, and you were freelancing. You said earlier on, you start talking about discipline, you know, like the discipline of freelancing as well. I mean, like, was that something you kind of found, or was it the fact that you took the freedom of freelancing and ran with it and allowed yourself to do more fiction?
Yeah, I think so. It immediately suited me, the fact that you could get up, as I often did, at 7 o'clock in the day and still start into your work, you know. It was fine, and like a lot of writers actually when you start out in your 20s, you tend to be often writing at night, and it changes actually as you get older. I'm very much a morning writer now, but it was it suited me straight away, the fact of freelancing and trying lots of different things. And I think now I still see myself as essentially a kind of a freelance operator, you know. There's always loads of different sort of projects on the desk and trying lots of things, because just the pragmatic economics of being a writer now You know, it's very unpredictable year to year where money is going to come from. So you have to try lots of things. So I've been writing little plays and making short films and doing radio plays, as well as writing kind of essays, as well as the fiction.
Yeah.
But it's like I love to mix it around like that as well, because writing one thing will really help you in another kind of area, you know? And it's I always think of this thing that Gore Vidal said. It was one of my favourite essayists. It was a brilliant, enviable essay style. And he was asked, where did you get that voice, you know? And he said, I think I got it when I was writing a load of stage plays in the early 60s. I started seeing an essay as essentially a kind of a dramatic monologue. And it's amazing how working on one in one form will suddenly make you much better in another area, you know? So I think it's a really good idea to try lots of things as well. Because you never know what you're going to be good at either.
Yeah.
You know, you could be a brilliant sci-fi writer and you don't know because you've never tried it.
Yeah.
So I'll chance anything, really.
Yeah. So again, let's suppose go back into the short story collection, then, Kevin. You know, and you kind of said that you've kind of been flan away at one, and sometimes they're terrible. You leave them there for a while. How long did it take you to get the first collection together? And like, did you approach kind of like, were you approaching a lot of publishers before you struck gold?
No, I didn't. I didn't approach any publishers really. I put one story into a competition, a big competition, the Davy Burns competition in Dublin, and for the simple reason that it was 20 grand. I saw the words 20 grand. Right away. Oh, you know, writers are very venal, and it wasn't short story that captured my attention, it was 20 grand captured my attention. And I got on the shortlist for it, and I got kind of an agent out of that, and it was Declan Mead, the Stinging Fly, had organised it, and he's very kind of laid back to the point of being a horizontal character. And started over the next year or two, yeah, started showing him a few different stories, and he kind of quietly said, "Well, if we had 10 or 11, we could do a little book." And I said, "Okay, grand." And there was never any kind of contracts or anything like that. So he made it sound very undramatic, like we were just going to sneak out a little pamphlet kind of thing. So I didn't have to panic about it, you know. So it was so fine, and it went very well, and it kind of set me up really, you know. But I was but the stories in that first book are from probably about 8 years up until 2007. You know, the earliest one would certainly have been written in the 90s and 99. Mm. The second collection is from a tighter kind of 4 or 5 year period. And I think it's possibly slightly stronger because of that. The themes are kind of more coherent and coming around the same areas more so.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I love writing short stories because I'm really impatient as a writer, and I love something that can be finished inside a week on your desk. And my favourite stories that I've written, and I think my best ones, are very often written very quickly, inside a week or two, you know. And that's a lovely feeling because novels take forever, you know. And
yeah,
to have something that's kind of finished or made, even if it's shite, is a nice feeling. And most of them aren't great, you know. I throw out, I'd say, 10 out of every dozen that I write. They never see the outside of the house. But it's I believe very strongly that you'll only be able to finish the good stories when they come along if you finish the bad ones as well. And even though I know it's kind of not great or a bit weak or a bit, I've done it before, I'll still kind of finish it always just as out of a kind of a professional ethic or something.
Yeah,
which I think just kind of disciplines you.
Yeah.
And you know, all the it's a cliche, but all the failures teach you a huge amount compared to what the successful ones teach you, you know?
Yeah.
When you can spot where you go wrong.
Yeah. You said there that, I mean, you and you said it a few times in interviews that you knew the minute you started, the minute you visited Bahrain for the first time, this is it. This book is going to be published, right? And there's another quote that I kind of came across. And you said you're great crack writing. Well, not great crack, great fun writing it. That like, I mean, it kind of like, it was like, fuck it, let's go for it, let's do it. Do you kind of think, you know, that like that was something as well that contributed to it, the fact that you kind of said that you don't like stuff that takes a long time to write. And you said that you wrote the novel in about 3 months, maybe the first draft of it. You know, that like, did you suddenly got an enjoyment out of it? Getting a kick out of this particular one because it was there right down to your fingertips from the first time you started talking about thinking about fiction.
Yeah, I mean, no, it took me a long while to realise that I should be having fun in the room, really. I should be having a good time, and that if I wasn't having a good time at this end of the process, the misfortunate reader probably wasn't going to have a great time at the other end of it, you know. So I always think of that kind of movie version of the writer's life where they're pacing up and down and he or she is balling up the pages and throwing them at the waste paper bin. And you think, geez, I don't want to read that either, you know, it must be dreadful stuff. And I just thought, Jesus, you know, have fun with it and just let it go. And I think also I found straight away that I had the kind of the voice for it. It just seemed to be ready at the time from the first page. I kind of knew what they sounded like,
yeah.
You know. And the accent in the city of Bohan is kind of at some midway point between Limerick and Cork. You know, it's kind of spiritually charitable. Yeah. Or something like that.
And I was thinking it's more like a hand.
Yeah, and it was a great thing actually figuring out what the place was called, because I had everything except the name of it, and I had a vision one night when I kind of sat up in the bed and went Bohan out loud, and I would have known people called Bohan in Cork. It's an old Cork surname, but it just seemed right. You know, that flat second hand. You know, that second syllable on it just seemed spot on. So yeah, I'm going back out there to write a second one in the autumn. So I can't wait to see what's going on in the city of Bohan. Not in good, I'd say. I'll actually give you a sneak preview of the first line of the second City of Bohan novel. That's all I'll say about it. I know the first line is, the city of Bohan was gone to fuck altogether. And we're just going to go from there then and see what happens.
But there was a swing to it and a swagger to it as well. And like, I'm very interested. You said that, like, I mean, obviously, all the books you read go into the book you write. But aside from the books, like TV series, films go into it, comics go into it. But like also music, you know. And it was kind of funny. I only read the interviews after I read the book, and you talked about calypso, and you talked about reggae, you know. So I was just going, I get it now, you know.
Yeah, I don't know with the music. I think everyone after a while, I don't know. You're very broad-minded, Jimmy. Listen to all sorts of stuff. After a while, I think for a lot of people, you find your zone where you're comfortable. And my thing over the years has become almost exclusively dub reggae. I listen to loads of old reggae records on a daily basis. That's usually what's on the record player or the computer at home, you know. And it so happened that they turned out to be listening to loads of dub reggae out in the city of Boa as well. And loads of the characters' names and stuff are stolen from the Trojan Records. Kind of roster, you know, there's a Prince Tubby in it instead of King Tubby and things like that. And lots of the chapter titles are taken from reggae songs and all that. I don't know where the calypso thing came from. Seemed like a good idea that morning to have them listen to calypso as well. But it was also what was in my mind was someone said to me one night, I remember in the Donkey's Ears pub, which is a great pub in Cork, you'd remember, which is a great reggae session. Someone insisted to me someone insisted to me that Cork accent was really a kind of a Caribbean accent. It was kind of a version of a Caribbean accent. You know, it can be in a certain kind of setting and stuff. But yeah, I mean, the music was very important to it. But also, I was writing it, I guess, in 2008 and 2009. And what I was probably most excited about in my own kind of cultural consumption at that stage were the TV box sets I was watching of, you know, The Wire and Deadwood. Like, Deadwood could almost sue me for the amount I robbed for City of Bohan. And The Sopranos and all that stuff, you know, I just loved those. And, stole loads from telly. And telly and music really were as important as any kind of literary influences on it. Even though, I love things like Clockwork Orange growing up as well, and the kind of style and swagger.
Well, the style and swagger comes off the pages in the book. I mean, I remember it's been taken with the descriptions of the clothes, the tailoring. I mean, that's a reggae thing as well, you know? I mean, it's very much so. But, like, there's a real style to it. Then I came across a very interesting article you wrote in 1992. You were reporting on the Cork as a style capital for hot press.
Where so isn't it blood? Oh, Jesus. Oh, well,
the archives, boy. But, like, you know, it was just a funny piece to find, you know? You were writing about Cork as a style capital, and then I was kind of thinking about, like,
that sounds like a stretch in 1992. Fucking hell!
But like, talk a bit about the style of Bohan. I mean, is this something that would be featured? What kind of catwalks were you influenced by? Where were you getting those ideas from?
It's completely from growing up and swapping your own clothes all the time and going through mod phases and goth phases and all sorts of ravery phases and all that, you know, and just presenting, you know, this look to the world, and suddenly you're completely different sort of character. I remember with friends, we went to for a summer to London, the traditional late 80s Irish young fellas gone to London somewhere, living in a squat and arsing around the place, and had kind of come out of the goth phase at that stage, and were kind of listening to, I don't know, what, Velvet Underground and kind of Leonard Cohen, and feeling slightly old before our time and not realising really that we wanted something else, you know. And suddenly seeing all these crazy looking kids around the street, this was summer 88, in kind of orange flares and bowl haircuts and weird sweatshirts, going, what the fuck? And their eyes were outside their heads, and it was this acid house thing starting. And all it took was we went to one night in the Camden Palace, and by the next day we had the orange jeans got. The haircut was being cut. You know what I mean? And it took literally about 3 hours, and you were a raver. You know, it was all, everything had changed. It. And I just loved the way, at a certain age, you could just change your clothes and everything has changed. You know, this kind of a front you present to the world, you know. Yeah. And also, I mean, in terms of City of Bohan, the place is fucked and they've nothing out there anymore. You know, there's no industry, there's no transport really even, there's nothing left, but they have the fucking swagger and the way they carry themselves. Yeah. And it's kind of, you know, and it's a gang opera as well. It's all about gangs, and gangs have to identify themselves. Somebody told me, actually, this woman came up to me. I was reading from it in Germany, and she designs for operas, and she said, do you realize that your clothes don't work in the book? She said, these costumes are ridiculous. That she said, try and imagine them in your eyes, Kevin, they don't work. I said, okay, I'll think about it for the next one. But it's the most fun, actually, I had, but it really was thinking about the costumes and the kind of atmosphere, because the great thing about writing a novel is you have no budget restrictions, you know. You can do anything, like, and I can have a huge gang war going on, and brilliant, cost me nothing, you know, just kind of, whatever you make up.
You said there, like, you know, that, like, you know, it's also about a front as well, and, you know, I'm curious about something as well you said in the previous interview. You said about, like, being working class kids, the details put into their clothes and all that, you know, and, like, again, with the language, again, I mean, obviously, as you said earlier on, the language in the book is taken very much from kind of Cork and Dublin working class culture. Do you think that dialogue's changed over the years? I mean, like, you know, you're someone who kind of was in Cork and Limerick, say, in the 80s and 90s, and I kind of hear this in Dublin, but, like, I've been in Dublin an awful long time, and the way the dialect up there has just changed so much in 25 years, you know, the way things have changed. Do you think something similar has happened down here as well?
Yeah, I think I had a very interesting conversation with a chap here about this, about the Limerick accent over the years, and because of things like the rubber bandits and stuff like that, you get kids kind of amping it up a bit now, you know, and really kind of playing up to it, you know, which is brilliant. Like, I'm really fascinated by accents, actually. And then the amazing thing about Ireland is it's a tiny island geographically, but the accent changes so much. Like, you know, the Limerick accent, you know, very fast and breakneck and 100 mile an hour, it lasts for about a mile and a half, you know, and then you get out over there to Clare and they're complete boggers, like, once you get there, you know. And it's amazing to me how I moved to rural Sligo then, South County Sligo. And Jesus, like, I couldn't
What's
figure out...
What's the accent like up there?
Oh, Jesus. Like, dragging rocks out of the back of a tractor. Like, it's... but, like, when the accent changes, everything changes. It's very kind of dry, you know, and very kind of deadpan, and the delivery very quiet, very kind of slow. And I was completely freaked out for about 2 or 3 years. I thought, Jesus, this place, you know, has no sense of humour or anything, like... Because the accent, it took me ages to realise they're actually winding you up and taking the piss all the time, but it's just done completely straight-faced and deadpan. Whereas down here, the humour is madcap and 100 miles an hour, and really, and it all comes out of cut the speech so quick and so fast, and fuck's sake, now, you know what I mean? And like the unbelievables could only have come from around here, the rubber bandits could only come from around here, and it all comes out of the way you kind of take the language and how you project it, you know. But it's something I'm kind of involved with all the time in terms of listening and you know, it what's really interesting about Irish speech and Irish talk and conversation is that there's so much hidden beneath the surface. We're kind of brilliant at it, really, and we love the sounds of our own voices and we talk a great deal. But it's all the kind of silent stuff that's going on just beneath the surface, all the kind of undercurrents and the silent kind of power battles and the kind of slags that have been, and you don't even realise it for about 3 months, what someone meant, you know, fucker, like. Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm always using this quote, and I think it came from Norman Mailer, and he was talking about men in general, but I always think of Irishmen. He said, whenever two men say hello to each other in the street, one of them loses. And it's just that sense of kind of these little tussles always going on, you know. And it's that's where you find fiction and drama and stories, I think, in that little space just underneath the babble of talk in there. So going around the place listening and kind of eavesdropping is a very critical method for me, you know, in terms of putting the work together.
I mean, after the book was published, you said there earlier on, like, you had great fun writing the book. After the book was published, you also had plenty of great fun as well, because, I mean, the book seemed to win every fucking award going, you know?
I mean,
you've won more awards than Limerick have won hurling matches in the last couple of years.
No, that's not saying, there's nothing not to love about getting awards and giving money. I love it, you know? It's fantastic, yeah. But it's... it's a kind of a strange time in publishing. You need such an enormous amount of luck now, not just generally over career, but with your early books, with your first couple of books, because if you don't make kind of an impact quickly with books now, it gets very hard to keep publishing, you know. So I was lucky that, you know, the moon was and the stars were aligned properly and I got
sometimes that happens though as well, Kevin. So it seems to me that looking at the way, like, say, the kind of like literary fiction side is going, that sometimes people get hyped very early as well, you know, and they don't seem to deserve it. And also what happens is they might get one book out and the first book kind of does okay, the second book nowhere near as good, and that's kind of say an aura for a while, you know. Whereas like, I mean, it struck me with you that, like, you know, not only was Bahama amazing and it got really well received and it did really well in terms of prizes, but, like, I mean, you were ready for it as well.
Yeah, I'm actually really, like, and I was sending out half-arsed novels to publishers in my late 20s, and I'm really happy in retrospect that I wasn't publishing, because it would have been, they probably would have done grand, but they were certainly not as kind of as properly realised as the first books I did bring out were, I think. Yeah. So I don't regret publishing my first slim volume of stories when I was 37, I think, and the first novel at 41 or something like that. You know, I've only learned to drive lately, so I'm on a provisional license at 46. I learned to swim when I was 29, and I finally mastered a bicycle when I was 16, I think. So there is a kind of a theme, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a flyer once I get going, you know? But it tends to take ages to get there, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so I suppose moving on then to, like, the new book, like you said there, you're going to return to the queer place in the autumn. We'll talk about that in a minute. But, like, I mean, in the meantime, there's a new book coming out. That's Beetlebone.
Yeah.
And tell us a bit about that, because, I mean, it's about John Lennon. It's about Clew Bay Mayo, and it's a totally different from what I've heard so far, read so far. It seems to be a totally different, like, dialogue, totally different theme to anything you've done before.
Yeah, it's It struck me again that almost all my ideas for stories or scripts or whatever I'm doing comes only when I get out of the house and when I actually get away for a while and go off on my bike around Mayo and County Galway and stuff like that. And since we moved to Sligo, I've been going out around kind of Clew Bay cycling in the summer. And one of that odd little things I had in my head about Clew Bay all the time was, you see all the tiny little islands that are, I knew somehow that, well, John Lennon used to own one of those. So it was kind of niggling at me, and I wrote a little piece for a magazine in Belfast about it, a tiny little piece thinking that will take care of that. But it kept coming back, and then I kind of wrote a little radio essay about it. And it's this tiny little island that he bought for 1,500 quid, visited twice in the late 60s for an hour, ever. Didn't give it to a commune for a while. And talked about renewing the planning permission with Mayo County Council just before he died. And just the fact of John Lennon having dealings with Mayo County Council just kind of... Yeah, I was thinking, I can't leave this alone. So I kind of... I alluded to it then in a short story. The story Dark Lies the Island. The island is John's island, and it's just mentioned. I was thinking, that'll take care of it now. But then I think just after City of Bohan came out, I suppose I was kind of subconsciously shopping around in my head for another novel. And I remember sort of having a nap on the couch one day. I usually pass out about 4:30 in a fit of the vapors up in County Sligo. And I was kind of lying there drooling, and I just suddenly went, fuck it, try it as a novel, you know? And my immediate thought subsequently to that was, oh no, you know, Jesus, because I knew it was going to be very risky to take such an iconic figure and try and give him a voice and try and plonk him down in one of your stories, you know? And I thought the only way to do this is really quick, do a mad, quick burst. It's going to be a mad, trippy, crazy story written in mad, trippy, crazy, psychedelic language. Go for it really quickly. It'll take you 6 months. And it took me 4 years. And it took an awful long time and an awful lot of drafts before I started to get a voice for him that sounded, yeah, that could kind of work. You kind of believe that's what he would sound like, you know? Yeah. So it was very strange. It's definitely... it took me a long while to get anything I was happy with. I'm finished it now, and I'm fairly happy with it. Like, it's nuts. It's really kind of wild story. He's trying to get to his island, and it's all going wrong. And he's in disguise, and he's going around the place in pubs and going around Mayo in a van with his sidekick. And it's it's kind of out there. Like, I'm interested to see how it'll go down, but it's. I've definitely never had to work harder on anything I've written before because it took so long, and to get the voice for it. And something actually in my kind of interviewing days, I remember interviewing James Kelman for the Irish Times once, and he said to me, "It's not fucking easy at a Gates, Kevin. You know, you have to dig them out harder." Like, the first couple of books are kind of, to use that horrible business expression, low-hanging fruit. You know, you can kind of, you have all the stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You can pick it out. But then you have to start digging harder and harder and harder to get the good stuff, you know. By the time, actually, I really enjoyed kind of the last year on it because I was kind of, I had the kind of tone or note, and I could kind of start inventing stuff at will, and it started to get very funny and things, I hope. So I enjoyed the last year. For the first 3 years in it were shoveling gravel, really, you know, writing loads of drafts. And, like, it's a short enough novel. It's 50,000 words. And I estimated, I was cleaning up the office after it, and I estimated I probably wrote about 300,000 words for it. And just cut, until the stuff I was left with sounded kind of, okay, that's kind of there, you know. So, yeah, it took a while. I had this big thing as well, you see, that probably made it harder in that I wasn't going to do any research at all.
She didn't go to the island?
Oh, I went to the island, but in terms of reading the books and all that stuff, I thought, because if you open that door with something like John Lennon and the Beatles, you know, just the world falls out on top of you. There's just so much stuff. So I went out to the island. I listened to the music a lot, you know. I listened to his early solo Primal Scream kind of records, Plastic Ono Band, and the White Album has always been one of my favourite records. I listened to that every day to get myself going. But it was... people are just starting to read early copies of it now, and it seems to be going down well enough. Great. So,
did you do some screaming when you were on the island?
I did a bit, yeah, because he was very into Primal Scream as a way of getting at buried pain and childhood trauma. So I said, I must have a go at this myself now while I'm out there. Didn't seem to do much for me at all. But it was really interesting to start to think about the West of Ireland in the kind of 1970s, around then, and the view of it maybe that we have comes out of kind of, you know, the view of it that you'd find in brilliant John McGahern books and stuff like this doesn't cover a whole swathe of crazy things that were happening there as well, with communes and really crazy radical little sects growing up. And he brought the first crowd in. They were called the Diggers, who he gave, it was a free love commune on Derrinish. And there was a screaming group up in Donegal at the same time as well. So it was really interesting, kind of buried piece of Irish weird cultural
totally.
History.
There's a singer in Edinburgh called Vashti Bunyan. She's a folk singer, and herself and her husband got a pony and trap in 1970 and went from Edinburgh over to Ireland because they'd heard there was a free farm available in East Galway, you know. And when they got there, they found it wasn't there at all. So they ended up in a commune out in Connemara. I remember interviewing her about it again, and she was kind of going, she was there with all these hippies in a commune in Connemara, and the rest of Ireland just didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, I'm amazed actually, again and again and again in my stories and in this book, crusties and freaks keep arising, you know. Maybe from my early days promoting raves and stuff, I was kind of involved with, I knew a lot of those people in Clare and in West Cork and stuff as well. And you kind of have to admire the choosing to live really out on the tip of things in lots of ways, you know.
Yeah.
And I always found them really kind of intense people in a kind of an interesting way. Mm. Half of me Egypts as well, but just out of grace.
Like Egypts. Yeah. Last question for me before we open up the floor for some questions. Have you already got a plot in mind for Girlie Hartnett when you go back to the Queer Place?
Well, she's definitely going to be there anyway, I'd say.
She's fascinating.
Yeah, I love her. She's going to be still going. And I think the character Ginny Ching is going to be back as well.
Yeah.
They're
very strong characters, very strong female characters. You're good at drawing them out.
I definitely thought I recorded the audiobook about 2 years after writing it, or 3 years even after writing it, and I found the bits that I was really enjoying reading were whenever I got to Girlie or Ginny Ching, and I thought like the big fault I found when I was reading it back then. And it's very instructive to read your whole novel start to finish after 3 years. You really see what's good and bad about it. I thought that the weakness was that there wasn't enough about the best characters, which I thought were those two. You know, I thought there could be way more about those two, and I think there will be in the next one.
Great, okay. Anyway, any questions for Kevin? Don't be shy.
Don't be shy.
As you can see, he'd answer anything.
Hi. It's been developed, as they say. Now the plan is as a television series, which makes loads of sense because it's all robbed from TV shows anyway. It's with a good Irish company called Parallel Films, who did a lot of the Pat McCabe stuff and things and do lots of stuff. They've done Brooklyn, the new film of the Cullum Tobin book, but it's. I'd have very strong ideas about cast in my mind, which I'm not going to say anything about. I wrote a couple of drafts as a feature Lent project.
Are you worried about the language? Will they keep it?
Yeah, I mean, that would be the obvious thing. See, it would depend how much money they got, you know. And if the worrying thing is the more money they get, the more compromises would have to be taken, I'd say, with dialogue and stuff like that. Like, God forbid if they got American money or something like that. Mm-hmm. What would happen? It's very interesting, actually, because it opened a massive bestseller. It developed a kind of good, kind of culty kind of readership in the US, and it's very interesting to have Americans coming up to you doing Bohan accents. I tell you. You know, and they sent weird things. They get sent photographs of, a Halloween party in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where they were all dressed up as characters from City of Bohan. I was like, fucking bizarre, you know. And he looked completely gaga, you know, just very strange. But it was, I'd love the idea of it as a telly thing, you know. I'm kind of definitely looking at the second book as season two, you know, that kind of way.
Any questions?
There kind of seems to be this, I suppose, kind of short story renaissance of late, if you could call it that, and. I remember hearing Colin Barrett a few months back and he claimed that you gave him permission to write short stories, which I thought was another way to put it, actually. I hope you didn't know that.
Oh, you don't mean I actually said you can... All right, I see what you mean, yeah.
No.
That's very nice of him, yeah. Right.
And it did kind of think, and actually, in many ways, you're probably the father figure of this
Thanks.
Short story.
You're saying lovely stuff to me. I love this. Keep going for another while. I'm only 46. I'm not that. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you agree that there has been this renaissance?
Yeah, I definitely. I think publishers aren't as scared of story collections as they used to be.
Yeah.
I think at one point, bringing a collection of stories into a publisher's office was like dragging a dead dog in and putting it down in front of them. Like, oh, you know. And still, they try and like to get a book of stories out. What I've done with the first two and with the next one, I'm going to do another collection of stories, is you kind of tie them in with a novel. You say, no, I'll give you a novel if you take a book of stories as well, kind of a thing. Loads of people are writing them,
yeah.
Which is what, and that's lots of good stuff is coming from that. I think it's because so many people, like I never went to writing groups or anything like that, because they weren't that common when I was kind of trying to write, but they're the perfect form for those kind of groups, you know, because it can be quickly kind of dissected and stuff and talked about. And that for that reason, there's thousands and hundreds of thousands of people writing stories. And obviously, there's going to be really good work as well. I mean, Ireland is at an unbelievable few years actually with stuff coming out low. Every other week there's some new genius showing up, which is brilliant, you know, and soul destroying as well when you have to deal with it. But it's it seems to have a really good kind of throb or kind of atmosphere at the moment for like, it's not something we should be complacent about, but it's still very good for books here compared to other countries. You know, the UK is like really struggling. I was talking to a writer, John McGregor, who's from Nottingham, and he was telling me Nottingham doesn't have an independent bookshop. City of 600,000 people. You know, there's a Waterstones and a shopping centre there or something, but that's it. And he said, imagine if Waterstones went, you'd have 500,000 city without a bookstore, you know. So it's, things are still very healthy here, really. And we can't be smug about that, but it's no, I think there's going to be lots of interesting stuff in the story form over the next while. I think as well, there's so much good stuff out there now in terms of music and film and telly and dancing cats on the internet and God knows what else. But you know what I mean? People have limited chunks of time to devote to stuff. So short stories, and I don't think they're kind of literary fast food or anything like that. I think they should be read very slowly and very carefully. But I do think the fact that you can, you know, have a really good kind of experience of a piece of prose fiction inside an hour or something makes it very attractive now for a lot of people. So it's no, it's a great thing that people are reading them again.
Yep.
I'd say you probably some of
I do, yeah.
I say so. I mean, I do it myself. When people kind of look at me funny and false, or whatever, and realize, you know, pieces that I just run through the entire conversation. It looks like this is not my warning at all. But I got that when I first read the poem.
Yeah.
The first 50 pages or so, I thought, this is saying New Orleans or Hell's Kitchen or something.
Yeah.
So that probably would have to do with reference to the reggae and the clothes and all that. Let me down and you're wrong. You must have consciously acted out these characters a lot of them.
Oh yeah, I do lots of it out loud at home. Yeah.
So I could hear when you mentioned one of your iconic influences earlier on when you started this presentation. The curtain.
Right.
I bumped into him this morning. You know, yeah. He was saying how disappointed he was that he wouldn't be able to make it.
I'd be on to text him. I don't know him properly at all, but we text each other.
Like, he's really, yeah. That quintessential limerick bitterness in the way he talks. You can only characterise as well.
Fuck yeah, kind of thing, yeah.
Give an example. He was talking about the demise of Val Dunican. And he said, you know, he says, I hate Val Dunican. He says, I wanted to go into the television and tear him fucking for the neck off me. He gave relaxation a bad name.
That's brilliant.
I could hear that voice in what you were writing. Were you consciously becoming those characters?
Yeah, oh, totally. And I have said, like, some people were telling me that they were struggling with some of the language in it. And I said, just read it in a Limerick or a Cork accent and you'd be grand.
But how would you deal with that? It's turned into a television thing. And it has superimposed it, this new generic.
I'd hide behind the couch, I'd say. But I'm sure, you know, it would be Irish accents if it happened. Oh God, that's a very dark prospect to put in front of me. But it's we have to wait and see. But it's I definitely find it a very important thing to act out and do it out loud. Because you catch all the kind of false notes very quickly when you do it out loud, and it's the best way of kind of when I know something is nearly there, that's why I print it out and I read it aloud with a biro on my hand and I cut, and that's always the fine letter, because your ear gets everything, you know. Your eyes can glaze over stuff on the page, but the ear will tell you where you're kind of stretching or where you're kind of not getting it, you know. The ear is your primary tool, really. Thanks. Cheers.
Time for maybe one more question.
A quote here that was taken by Yeats lately. Why should we honour only those that die upon the field of battle? A man may show as reckless a courage in entering into the abyss of himself. Yeah, I heard it beforehand, but it's, you know, so Does the abyss affect your stomach?
It's a really weird thing, actually. I've often talked whenever start talking to another writer, you know, it very quickly descends into massive fucking hypochondria, you know, all complete hypochondriacs. And I notice now, like, I have a thing, like, when I'm coming to the end of a book, my stomach is in ribbons. You know, there's an awful lot of nervous tension. It's weird, you're at your desk all the time and you're kind of nervous about it, you know, because you think I could fuck this up at any stage now. And I was finishing the Beetlebone book in kind of May, and I was destroyed. I was really fucking dodgy stomach, and literally the day it went out the door, I was grand. 100% flying it, you know, not a bother. And it's amazing the effect it has. What you're dealing with, you see, is you're dealing with your subconscious places. That's where the fiction is coming from.
You're living inside your nerves.
That's probably the line I probably overuse a bit, but when you're kind of, when you say as a writer, I'm going into work in the morning, what you mean is I'm about to crawl into my nerves and see what I can find in there and see what I can do with it, you know? But it's, when you are kind of back there and trying to channel into your subconscious places, it's kind of, you know, your whole system is kind of a little bit wired, I think. So I think you kind of learn your rhythms, and you know, like when I finish something long like that, I'm kind of not taking it easy now, but writing shorter pieces and bits and bobs and not committing to anything too long for a while. You know, I'm giving myself 3 or 4 months. Like, first drafts are easy enough, actually. You know, it mightn't be going great on the page, but you're not that kind of tense about it. But when it's late on in a project, you're feeling kind of, fuck, I have to get this kind of right now. And I was, I had a dodgy May, but it was grand then since I seen the book out. But quote.
Was it pressure from Canongate? Because, I mean, you signed a 3-book deal with them. So when you say about the nervous energy and that nervous kind of tension, would that be caused in any way by, having someone like Jamie Bing on the phone wanting to know what's going on?
Oh, no, Jamie's grand. Jamie's at home listening to his reggae records. That's all he does, is fine. But no, it's nervous for the work itself, you know? Yeah. I mean, I don't take myself at all seriously in any way, I hope. I think I'm, you know, an idiot, like. But I take the work extremely seriously. And what's going on the page, you know, I'm really obsessive about it and really kind of compulsive about it. And I get very involved with it, yeah. So it's, but you have to kind of put these pressures on yourself, I think, to come up with anything that has any chance to kind of lasting and getting there.
Cool, that's great. Kevin Barry, everybody. Cheers. Thank you very much. Thanks very much to Shane from Make a Move for inviting us down to do it. Thanks to Ger for all the help with the sound. There's loads more stuff on with Make a Move tonight, so just check out the website for more on that. And Kevin will be breakdancing out of here, so make sure you buy his new book when it comes out in the autumn. Thanks very much. Bye bye.
Cheers. Thanks.
Thanks a million to Kevin for his time, and to Shane and all of the Make a Move Festival for the invitation and hospitality. This podcast was produced by series producer Tanya White. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate us and spread the word. Tell your friends about us, recommend us on your favourite social media network, leave a review or a rating on the iTunes store, and don't forget to subscribe. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news of what we're up to at Banter, makeamove.ie for all the word from Shannon's side, and we'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.